Sarkis, Duncan Sarkis, welcome to Cinematica. The Sarkis brothers, like the Taviani brothers or the Dardenne brothers.
Like you've chosen some quite fancy brothers.
Yeah, there's also some pretty ordinary brothers around, like the John brothers and the Smith brothers.
Anyway, it's a real it's a real pleasure to have you with us. You're here to talk about Two Little Boys, and this is the first time you guys have worked together on a feature project since 1999, Scarfies. According to IMDb, or have you been working together on projects that
we've been constantly working. It's just this is the first one that's been made.
The frustrating thing with IMDb is it doesn't recognise unmade projects, you know. You've got to actually have a movie made for it to be on there, which, you know, seems a bit unfair because, you know, there's a lot of people in Hollywood who all they do is make unmade scripts. In fact, there's people
making a very good living,
making much better living than we are. Occasionally making films and generally making unmade scripts.
But it's also the New Zealand way, isn't it? That, you know, filmmakers are constantly working on projects, trying to get projects up, getting funding, getting into development. You know, we're on a smaller scale, we work exactly the same way, don't we?
Yeah, but I don't think it's specific to New Zealand. I think there's Hollywood, and then there's the rest of the world, and the way we work is the same as the rest of the world outside of that mainstream sort of Hollywood, you know, bigger budget system, which is, you know, it's always a struggle, you know, creatively, financially, the whole thing. You know, you're really, you know, doing it because you're passionate about it, but you get a lot of benefit out of it as well, which is basically freedom to make what you want to make.
This is your third feature, correct, Robert? Am I right?
Technically it's Duncan's third feature as well.
Oh yeah, true.
Well, I was just thinking, as a director, that you in New Zealand terms, you know, Getting to make a third takes you into sort of fairly elevated territory, you know, in terms of New Zealand directors. There's not many people that, you know, there's lots of people get to make a first one, and then some get asked back to make a second. And then, you know, once you get to making a third, you're sort of into elder statesman territory, aren't you, in terms of the industry?
It shows that you're a real stickler for punishment, I think, if you've gone for a third, because you refuse to let go of the idea. You just stick at it. Because I would say that there's a huge amount of this has eventually come from persistence, because most sensible people go, God, this is difficult, this lifestyle that we've chosen, making films, so I might just hop off this train, but Rob and I have stuck it out and probably learned to be a little bit more savvy along the way. And
but it's not just hop off this train. Maybe it's find another train somewhere else in Australia, or in making commercials in overseas somewhere. You know, some people try and keep, you know, they try and convert those skill sets and that experience into a career somewhere else, but you've stuck it out here. How have you managed to do that?
Well, by not just making films. To be fair, I mean, you find ways to survive. In the past, I made a lot of commercials, and that, you know, my passion was never making commercials. Whereas I was often making commercials with people or alongside people whose passion was commercials, and they've become very successful making commercials. But more often than not, haven't made films. I was making commercials, and I don't so much now. I was making them to fund the development of the next film. So I do commercials. I do sometimes a little bit of television work. Whatever you can, and then you get. The thing is that this actually making films, I don't think a lot of, I mean, probably your listeners would realize, but a lot of people in the outside world, you know, wouldn't realize just how much time it takes in development. We've been developing Two Little Boys. This is kind of ridiculous, because really it's just a sort of a bogan comedy, really. It's not high art, but we have been developing. It's an epic bogan comedy, but it's still a bogan comedy, you know. But, you know, it sort of almost seems embarrassing to admit that, you know, we've been really developing it very actively for the last 5 years.
It's eaten up a fair amount of your life.
Yeah, and sure, not constantly. You know, you kind of go in and then come out, and that's actually a good way to work. And, you know, we jump between projects when we're in development as well to kind of keep things fresh. But definitely the last 3 years has been pretty much full time two little boys, especially for me and
especially for Rob.
Yeah,
it
takes a lot of time to make, and then in the development phase, it takes a long time to gestate. In fact, we were just talking in the office yesterday about, why does it take us so long? And I think that I guess we have an expectation on ourselves that we want our stories to have kind of a depth to them, even if we're making an epic Bogan comedy. You know, you still want it to kind of, I don't know,
work on a few levels.
You definitely do, and I think as you mature, quote unquote, as a filmmaker, your expectations on yourself are higher. You know, you want to keep making interesting work, and in fact, I think there's a responsibility for slightly more, you know, like, say, mid-career filmmakers, which what seems to be the trendy term for something that's pretty untrendy. the mid-career film, I think there's a certain responsibility on mid-career filmmakers to be pushing the boundaries a bit. You know, it's, we have that opportunity. You know, why just make something that is like what everyone else is making when we can make something that's shocking and gross and ridiculous and the sort of thing that you'd think that Film Commission would never fund?
The blackest of black comedies.
Totally.
In fact.
Yeah, totally.
Just before we move on to the next part of the interview, I just want to come back to this the idea of making TV commercials, because there was a time when TV commercials in New Zealand were incredibly well funded and they were little mini dramas, and so directors could use TV commercials as a practice for working with actors and, you know, telling little stories. They got to work on a relatively big canvas at times, and now TV commercials seem to me just flashing captions. And there's a lot of missed opportunities for actors now as well, because actors used to keep themselves alive with TV commercials. But do you feel like there's a reduction in the numbers of ways in for directors now, like that, in terms of getting experience and getting credits and getting showreel stuff?
Well, actually, no, because back when I started, 20 or so years ago, TV commercials and television was sort of the only way in. Whereas now you can go down to Harvey Norman, buy a camera and be shooting a feature film. So there's actually more opportunities to get a way in and to work your craft and figure out how to do this.
Which is so much better.
Which is actually a lot better. I mean, I often found, even when I was making commercials, I saw a lot of people around me who were incredibly talented, and they're just making friggin' commercials,
I remember it was sad.
Like, I mean, sure, the commercials were great. The commercials through the 80s, when I wasn't so much working, but then through the 90s, when Lee Tamahori was still making commercials and others, amazing. The commercials were the best thing on television. Personally, I think it's probably better that the best thing on television now is the programs.
Right.
So I don't think we're really going back.
So I'm over-romanticising there a wee bit. That's good to know.
I used to think that the number of people who got into making feature films through TV commercials was directly related to how many shitty feature films were made here, because, I came in, and Robert did as well, from more of a theatre-y background, and any background where you're involved working with actors and learning to tell stories, one would think ought to be a far better training ground for making a feature than developing a craft for making 30-second, albeit beautiful, 30-second presentations. So, sure, you get to learn how to work with a crew and you get to learn certain skills and deal with a lot of pressure, and so that's a very valuable tool to learn. But I was astonished that, I did some dramaturging, I remember, for a while, for at the same time I was doing dramaturging for a filmmaker who I won't name, who was making a horror film, and at the same time working on a Young and Hungry theatre piece for a playwright and helping them, and just the filmmaker had written their script, but I felt like I was having to teach the filmmaker just the most basics of storytelling and characters, and it was real and compared to the person who was earning nothing writing stories for theatre, it was just there was no comparison in the amount of skill from someone that wasn't getting the opportunity to someone that was getting the opportunity. So I actually think, thank God that it's less of a career path to go, oh, I've made a couple of commercials and now I can make a film. Thank God for YouTube and for things like the 48-hour film festival and all these things where people actually make films, and the Dean Hewitons of the world or various people, they're out there making something instead of some crappy commercial.
One of the things that I love about 48 Hours, and I think it comes back to your theatre story as well, is that there's you make a film, but you also have to sit and watch it with an audience.
Absolutely.
Which is not necessarily the YouTube method, you know, where you just watch numbers come up and you've got comments. There's something about sitting in an audience, watching your work, and then feeling the squirming or feeling the laughter and getting a sense of what works in a real live way. And, you know, I've worked on 48 Hours for a long time, and one of the things that I've noticed with teams is that quite often their first film is made basically to amuse their flatmates. And then they sit with an audience of 200 and realize that they're the only ones laughing. And the next time they've got a sense that they have to broaden their perspective, that they have to think about other people. And that's something that they wouldn't get if they were just throwing something at a YouTube page, maybe.
I think it's very clear that I think that we'll be looking back in 10, 20 years and seeing the 48-hour festival as, you know, a massive turning point in the next generation of New Zealand cinema. And I think that's an incredibly positive thing for exactly the reason that you've talked about. And also that it's so democratic, you know, like, you know, nowadays anyone can make a film, so it does come down to, well, are they actually interesting storytellers?
Yeah.
You know, it's not about how much money they've got or how many friends they've got in the right places, any of that. I think that that's an amazing event.
Yeah, and watching teams grow and get better and better each year is a real pleasure. Yeah.
And the only weakness with it, I think, is that, but it's not really a weakness, but it's just that it'll teach people how to imitate genres. So genre imitators do well at that, rather than figure out how to craft their own
originality.
Yeah,
suffers
but
a wee bit.
That said, you know, restrictions are great, and we now think of what exists now with the 48-hour film festival is exactly replicating, or very close to replicating, what was the biggest thing for Rob and I growing up, which was the spot-on filmmaking competitions that Rob invented. Rob was in every year as a director, and then I was in as a script writer because they had a different section there. And those were huge carrots in our development, you know, a massive, the fact that Rob had something that he could enter and strive for and work to get better and better. Rob became so experienced in his teenage years with a bunch of films I'm sure he never wants anyone to ever see, but that I'll get hold of them and leak them to the archives or something, you know.
Well, I think surely there's some DVD extras that are just exactly. crying out to go on to.
Oh, you have a word to me, Dan. I'll see what
well,
I can.
Fortunately, people aren't that fascinated.
Well, you know, it is
interesting seeing the development, though,
yeah.
isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and you know, fully when people are doing their PhDs on the Sarkis brothers, then they're going to want access to those films. So, you know, you owe it for posterity to have them out there.
Yeah, just quite.
Otherwise, it's going to be a fairly thin PhD, isn't it?
Currently, you need to thicken it up. That's right.
Duncan,
how did people who made such shitty films when they were kids end up making something that was actually reasonably good when they were adults?
Isn't it the same thing, though, that you sort of think of how no one could have predicted that? Like, I loved Bad Taste when I first saw Peter Jackson's Bad Taste, but you never would have predicted that guy was going to go and make Lord of the Rings or these epic. But then you can then look, go and go.
Going backwards, you can sort of see the threads, can't you?
Yeah, you can go, okay, no film commission development there. So clearly, and that's nothing against the film commission, it's just here's clear evidence that someone was determined to do it and to do it again and again and to self-fund and do it their own way. And then you can just, you can actually look at the sort of genesis of there are people that will make a film regardless or not of how much help they get from the outside world. And when the outside world, there are times when you're doing well with the outside world and you're riding a wave, and there are times when no one's interested and there's a lot of drop off in those times. And but in those times, it's really the ones in those times that stick it out and are still determined, stupidly minded, pig-headed determination.
A friend of mine once talked about actors in the same way, and that when you're in your 20s, there's actors on almost every street corner, but if you can stick it out until you're in your 40s and 50s, you might be the only one left, you know, so there'll be a whole lot of work for you.
Brilliant strategy, but there's a lot of cafe work.
I think that the best strategy is to skip being an actor from your 20s to your 40s and then become an actor in your 50s and 60s.
Yeah, that's fair enough. We talked a little bit earlier about Robert's, how Robert's been keeping going between feature projects and while feature projects have been developed. Duncan, since 1999, as a writer, I guess you can be maybe a lot more of a self-starter. What sort of stuff have you been doing to sort of keep you going while film projects are working?
So I guess there's two levels of keep me going. There's a financial level of keep me going and keep me surviving, and there's a level of just keep inspiration up. So on the financial front, I could say that basically the film work with Rob was often paying for one third to half of a life, and I was able to live cheaper earlier on, and now it's a bit harder. So that would look after a lot, but then, you know, like a lot of people, scraping for any little buck that they can earn, like some two-bit hustler, you know, two-bit creative hustler. You know, turn up and give a talk there and take your $100 and you'll need that.
Yeah.
And then I actually taught business writing for a while, which I actually got a real thrill from because it was so different. And I actually really enjoyed it. And it was great to have a regular wage, and that arrived just at the right time for me to get some stability. And also, I was having a problem with the idea that the very thing that you have a love for, the sort of creative streak, if that's the thing that you've become totally determinant on to earn a buck, but the earning the buck part of it might be things like writing for television that you don't like, you're in danger of killing that very streak within you. So it was nice to find a way to earn money that was quite divorced from that.
But still related to writing.
And you perform as well, like you write stuff for yourself to, you tour the one-man show.
So the advantage that I get over Rob and sort of my lifestyle, because it is true, for a film director, it's quite clearly all-encompassing and one project will just completely dominate you. And whereas for me, working with Rob, this is something that both Rob and I have done. For sanity levels, it's been quite a smart thing to always just have something of your own on the go. I personally don't like the idea of endlessly writing film scripts that never get seen, which is always a risk when you're a film writer. So for me, I always needed an outlet. So the fact that you don't have to invest $1 million into putting a book out. You don't have to invest $1 million into putting a theatre show out. So for me, much more sort of instant feelings and reactions and working in genre. So I did a show called Instructions for Modern Living, and me and my friend Nick McGowan toured all over, you know, various interesting spots in the world, and definitely did a show of short stories. And I don't know, I just described it as bits and pieces.
You wrote a book called $2 Boys.
I wrote a book, and I wrote books as well.
Very elegantly bringing it back to the subject at hand, Robert.
Nice one, Robert.
Yeah, exactly.
Should be a producer, huh? Well,
let's talk about $2 Boys then, because it is a novel. And it's a novel that I reviewed for Radio New Zealand, I think, back in the day. And I was going to ask, was it always going to be a novel, and then you had the idea for expanding it out, or where did the inspiration come from? Oh God, what a horrible question!
No, it's all right. It's a question. I mean, in actual fact, Rob and I were jamming ideas for film ideas and for all sorts of things, and this has happened more than once with us now, actually. But There was a lot of inspiration came flooding out, and often in the process of writing up film ideas anyway, got into a real habit lately, which I think is a good habit, of writing up prose anyway, because prose is so much sort of richer than, well, it's not richer than film script form, but it's just easier.
It's denser.
Access, and it's, you're going through a character's headspace rather than trying to think of this visual world. And so it's been, it's easier to get a flow on, and it's so been such a useful device then for Rob and I to then look at this sort of stuff and analyse where's the story here, where's the story, how's this going. So as part of a process towards an older project called Two Little Boys, I was writing screeds and screeds of the same two characters. Rob was looking at all this and seeing that that it was all flowing out of me like a power vomit and encouraging me to just keep going with these guys, keep going. At a certain point, which I can't exactly locate, but we certainly built it up, and it became, God, we thought about it as a film idea, we thought about it as a TV series idea, we thought about it as in all sorts of levels and genres. But there was a certain stepping off point where effectively I said to Rob, I'd really love to write this as a novel, and Rob said, go for it. And
which was the point where I got Out of the Blue happening, needed to sort of step away from Duncan for a couple of years. So right. It was pretty convenient. I mean, Duncan and I worked on a couple of projects before Two Little Boys that didn't happen, and hopefully at least one of them will happen. I felt that we needed to sort of invigorate our creative process by just, and for me that was just about giving Duncan some freedom, and so encouraging him to just write was great to see, because really in the first day of just write anything, Dunk, it doesn't matter, he had those power vomits. And for me, it was really just a process of simply encouraging him to keep writing, and sometimes that's all a writer needs, especially in, well, certainly all a writer like Duncan needs in the early stages. The less blocks, it's almost like a sort of a parental figure just going, yeah, that's really great. And I mean, I wouldn't say it's really great if it wasn't really great, and I was really loving the material. But once we got a lot of material sort of together, and we're talking 100 or more pages of prose, then we started writing it up as a film script, and we sort of got a bit lost somewhere, and sort of started to question things. And that was the point where Duncan, where I stepped off to Out of the Blue, and Duncan went and kind of took it to Penguin. The funny part of that story, sorry, I've just basically retold that story again, but you can cut that. But the funny part of that story is that essentially when Duncan went to Penguin to ask them, well, essentially when Duncan came to me to ask me if he could write this as a novel, it was a film company that was giving permission to to a literary company to kind of to write a book, which is sort of the opposite way.
There's lots of precedents. It's interesting. I've heard The Godfather actually. They wrote a film script for The Godfather. No one was interested. It wouldn't get taken up. So the guy chose to write it as a novel, and then suddenly there was interest in it as a film.
And that's interesting, isn't it? How you almost need to go a few extra steps to prove to funders or producers or whoever that the idea that's in your head actually does have the legs that you say it has.
Well, I think that the tricky thing about what we and any filmmaker does, our job is to make the intangible tangible, right? An idea is the most intangible thing in the world, right? It's synapses in someone's brain, who cares? Is that worth spending, $100 on, let alone, a few million? Mm. It takes a lot to turn that idea into something that we can see on a screen. And I guess, I mean, that's been the frustration for Duncan and I over the years, is, you know, you don't get a chance to make many of these intangible things into something as tangible as a film. What I think happens as soon as you write a book, it takes a huge amount of effort, you know, to do from Duncan, but it turns it into something tangible, right? And I think the film industry likes that. They respond to that tangibility, right? It's a thing, right? And if it's a thing, then it can become another thing. I mean, it was an accidental process that just sort of happened.
I don't know, you know, I think the one thing that I don't want to, well, ideally I'd like to never do it again, but it's likely to happen again, but I don't want to write things that never see the light of the day. Rob and I have written a film script that we certainly want to make one day called The Magnificent Magic Fingers. But in the meantime, while a lot of friends have gone out and put out work that everyone's loved and, you know, and you see the thrill of it, we've got this thing sitting in our cupboard going, we did some of our best work and no one has seen it. And that, to me, is enormously frustrating. And I think, it's not just a sort of a mercenary case of you write it. I think it's wonderful to write something and you make something. And because someone doesn't have to invest $1 million in it, you have to really embrace that medium. You can't just be, there's no point in going, you know, I'm a film writer and I'll just, as some kind of cynical exercise, write a book so it can become a film. That would never work. For me, it's all about embracing what that medium brings. And for me, the very thing that I love, that actually sometimes I can find frustrating within film to figure out how to do, is I love getting inside someone else's head and forcing a reader, and therefore myself as a writer, to live in someone else's head completely. And that's a real thrill, and having a real buzz out of writing prose. And then you make something, and then I've got it out of my system. I made something, and there it is, and it's out. And it's not like Magic Fingers, which for me is very frustrating.
And curse you, it's out of your head, but now it's in ours. Because these two characters are, you know, they're funny, but they're immature, obviously. They're dark, they're selfish, they're not terribly bright, they're not terribly self-aware. They go to some extremely dark places. And also, these two characters, they've known each other since they were very, very young, school kids. Did you draw on your own relationship for any aspects of the relationship between those two characters?
When you say our own relationship,
yeah,
you as Rob and I.
Yeah.
Not so much. There'd certainly be little bits in there. There would be some parts, but less than you'd think. I think probably more inspiration would have come out of the way Rob and I grew up in Dunedin and the people that we were surrounded by in Dunedin, because it's still remarkable to me that most people who grow up in a town don't actually leave that town. I'm not. This isn't me begging Dunedin or any town, actually. It happens here in Wellington too. Most people start up in a town and never leave that town. And you know, having left a place, I don't know, you then look back at the experiences you had. And with two little boys, it's very much like I can separate my life in Dunedin into two phases, into my pre-university days and post-university. And university really spun my world around and opened up a big universe to me. But pre that, the world I lived in was far more like the world of two little boys. Of course, it, you know, not quite as extreme, but on that level, you know, the characters you could describe are, we probably weren't working class. I probably used to kid myself that we were working class, but Dunedin middle class is more like Wellington working class. You know, it's very different. It's a very different society. So I think more along those lines. If you just say what out of Rob and my relationship relates to it, there'd be a little bit of control stuff in the fact that Rob is older, so therefore he's always been a director personality. And certainly we've got this well out of our system in our mid-20s where Rob stopped being a kind of a dominant figure in that kind of way than he had been because there's a 3-year age gap and it's a decent sized age gap. So as a younger kid,
In your teenage years, yeah, absolutely.
In teenage years, there's always that thing probably with a younger sibling where a younger sibling has to figure out that mix of how do I stamp out who I am, and you know, so there would have been a few things there, but I probably drew more out of other types of relationships.
I want to talk about the location now and the Southlandness of it. And was it always intended that would be where these characters would inhabit, or was it characters first and then let's find somewhere for them to live?
Well, it was characters first, and they lived originally in Dunedin, and but they were always in the book and in the early prose writing that when we were initially developing a film idea, they always were going to go on a road trip to the Catlins from Dunedin.
But the characters were always very, like, it was written in Dunedin or something because we know Dunedin, and so that therefore it comes flooding out of you, and Dunedin versus Invercargill. I mean, the fact there is just that Invercargill actually has a lot of similarities with Dunedin. You know, our sister school when we were at Cocker Valley High School was James Hargis. And yeah, always sort of had a feeling that Invercargill, that it was quite a similar life down in Invercargill to what we were experiencing in Dunedin. I never really thought that it would be that different, if anything, even more accentuated.
Yeah. I mean, I think that in a way this relates to the characters themselves. You know, the characters, as you've observed, they're quite extreme personalities, you know, and that really suits comedy because it gives you kind of a comic, well, I mean, you know, a lot of comic characters are pretty extreme, you know, maybe they're, you know, and so those extreme personalities who also, for the story to work, need to have a certain naivety to them. I mean, it's called Two Little Boys because it's essentially two little kids in growing, you know, mid-20-year-old bodies. it's that sort of world of those characters needed to sit in a world that feels somewhat naive, right? Somewhat more simple,
unworldly,
somewhat unworldly, and so really that could be any small town, pretty much anywhere in the world, but it couldn't be a city, right? It couldn't be a big city. In fact, I'd argue...
couldn't be a liberal city.
No, in fact, in a way, it could be Dunedin back when we were growing up in Dunedin, which Dunedin was quite a depressed place now. I mean, Dunedin was quite a depressed place then in the 80s. You know, basically, last one out closed the door, you know, certainly in a business sense. Well, that's completely... the whole place is completely transformed, really. It's quite a hip place now. It's got its own, you know, fashion awards and film scene. So I think that just the world of the film needed to fit these characters. If you have a disconnect there, then you'd be in trouble and people wouldn't buy it. Now, it's one of the other reasons that we chose to set the film back in the 90s, you know, and it wasn't just because, you know, it's a lot of fun with costuming and we could relate to it with our childhood and stuff. It's also, you know, it's like kids are hipper now, you know, they wouldn't make some of the choices that these guys make. And so, you know, you just try and find, I guess in any storytelling, you're just trying to find the right path through that seems to make sense of, it seems to make sense for the world of these characters. I mean, we had a really odd moment when we once, long time ago, actually pitched the story to a TV network. Because we thought, oh, maybe actually their lives together could make a really great TV series. Yeah, it probably could, actually.
It's the prequel to the film.
It's the prequel to the film. This has been, yeah, it's been a long journey. But... and the network executive, you know, was quite interested in our pitch, you know, and definitely responding to it on a level. But the first question she asked was, could you set this in Auckland? And our hearts just sunk. We just knew, no, you could not set this in Auckland. We could set it almost anywhere else other than Auckland or Wellington or Christchurch,
yeah,
probably.
Auckland. You know, oh, no, Christchurch would be all right.
Maybe,
but
yeah.
Auckland,
yeah,
and Wellington.
Maybe, yeah. Yeah. But there's something about Invercargill being the last stop before Antarctica. Really, it's like there's an extremity. Yeah. About Invercargill that means that it's sort of there. The character's otherworldliness is reflected in the kind of otherworldliness of the place as well.
Yeah, and we forget that, I think, in New Zealand. I mean, New Zealand itself is the last, from an international perspective, is the last stop before Antarctica. So we've sort of gone to the last stop of the last stop, and I think that gives us some permission to kind of to push things a bit, you know. I mean these two characters very much exist in their own incredibly isolated world. They've been in a relationship or a friendship for 15 years, and the problem has been that's been their lives, right? And really the story is about the Brett McKenzie character trying to break out of that life and find another life, a more satisfying, a richer life, a life that will actually lead somewhere, whereas the Hamish Blake character just wants it always to be the same.
Yeah, well, let's keep it the same. And that does really represent that sort of moment when we're often all at a crossroads and some people stay and some people go.
Yeah. The catalyst for the story in the film is a tragedy. And yet, it's an extremely amusing moment in the film, and that opening scene where Brett's character is trying to deal with the after effects of the stupidity that he's perpetrated. It sets the tone straight away for the sort of black comedy that we're going to experience through the film as a whole. How have audiences responded to that? Do they buy it straight away with the direction you're going to take with the film, or are people sort of horrified?
I think they buy it because we work pretty hard to make the opening pretty silly, I think with anything Duncan and I do, we're never trying to do just one genre, and you know, we could equally be criticized for that, but we could also equally be celebrated for it. I mean, actually, I think it's a great thing for filmmakers to be trying to bounce around between genres and to, you know, not fit within, you know, a box. I mean, yes, I guess Two Little Boys is a black comedy, but we never think that way when we're setting out to write something. We just go, is there a story here? What's happening on these characters? Can we find some depth within it? And is it naturally funny?
I'd like to think that opening is a little bit like the Darwin Awards in that sense. And you often do read about crimes as well on page 5 of a newspaper or somewhere deep in a newspaper. It's the comedy item of the news where you couldn't believe that someone did something so ridiculous and made so many bad decisions. But I just think the Darwin Awards, but with survivors, and it's great.
Yeah, there was a story in the latter point of when we were writing this, that ridiculous story of, is it Tony Stadlick? The hand that was found, the severed hand that was found out at Red Rocks in Wellington. Yeah. You read that story, and basically these two guys, who I presume are now in prison, they cut off the hands of their drug dealer or their drug dealer friend before dumping his body in the sea, because they in 2000 and whatever it was, 7 probably or around then, they naively assumed that way no one would be able to identify him. You know, so when people kind of
do they not watch CSI?
Well, exactly. When people look at something like, say, Two Little Boys and goes, oh, these characters are really stupid. Well, actually, look around, read page 5, you know, go out, go to a pub somewhere that's not in central Auckland or central Wellington, and you will find people who think different to you.
There is logic involved, yeah. But it's just that the logic might be a bit misguided.
It's a bit naive,
and it has that wonderful momentum about it in terms of bad decision being piled upon bad decision, to the extent where it's not very far into it before you can't unwind it.
Yeah, and that's the Dino character, as he's a wonderful character for all of it, simply because he's a guy that's real act now, think later. And he thinks, because whereas you've got a character in Nige who any situation he'll freak out and he'll be thrown into some kind of paralysis. So he needs that friend, and he thinks initially that that friend is making good decisions on his behalf, but actually that friend is, he's the guy that wanted to be in World War One and jumping from trench to trench, and he might have got lucky, but it's all adrenaline
action.
He's an action hero on some levels, and yes, he's thinking on his feet, and he is thinking, but sometimes it could have been wise for him to just take a little bit more time with his plans, but he's able to
perhaps
run off the adrenaline.
I mean, I think there's a difference here. I mean, it's clearly these aren't smart characters in the way they think. There's a logic to how they think, but they're short of a few cells. Would be a polite way of putting it, I guess. But I think there's a real difference between having stupid characters and having stupid writing. You know, what we've really tried hard to do is, you know, put these characters, well, initially Duncan on the page and then on the screen. They're kind of stupid characters, but there's actually a real depth to them, particularly an emotional kind of depth to them. You know, they're emotionally actually quite complex, and the emotions of these on the surface,
and those motivations, characters. There's some very deep motivations going on.
Yeah, and there's actually a real kind of a real sadness in there to some of those emotions. I mean, particularly like the Dino, the Hamish Blake character, who, you know, on a top level, some people might describe as a psycho, a bit of a psychopath. He's kind of crazy, you know, and it's got a great energy for the story because he keeps making things worse. But just look not very far beneath the surface, and the film does this a lot, and you'll see someone who is incredibly emotionally fragile and tender and just has a desperate need to have one friend in life. Well, don't we all? You know, I mean, most of us are lucky enough to have more than one, but this guy, mostly because he's got that hard exterior, just has one. So the stakes are incredibly high for him. So I think, I mean, I hope that, you know, some people who see the film, and it's certainly been the case with some people who've read the book, you know, can do look sort of beyond that, the kind of the more obvious humour and the kind of the standard sort of bogan stuff, and kind of see that it's actually, or hopefully they can just feel it, that there's quite a lot of sort of depth under it. It's certainly been a lot of thought put into it, which is kind of crazy when you think of what the story is, but we do think about these things a lot.
Well, and you were saying earlier on, with 5 years of living with this, with these characters and living with this story, that's a long time to add those layers and weave all those strands together. The film was shot a couple of years ago. Am I right?
No, it was shot
18 months ago,
at the beginning of at the beginning of last year.
Right. And it's there was a premiere, wasn't there, in Venice?
Berlin.
Sorry, I knew it was one of the posher overseas festivals. So Berlin last year.
No, Berlin this year.
This year?
Yeah.
Was it?
Yeah.
Yep. Start of this year.
Do you want to start that question?
Yeah, I might actually retract that entire question.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it seemed to me that the film's been hanging around for a while without. Like, I know that.
There's all sorts of funny biz in the film world where it's like, oh, you've got to wait for the Rugby World Cup and you've got to wait for this.
The Rugby World Cup is actually the key reason.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's all the Rugby World Cup.
And yet another casualty.
And then Brett went and won an Oscar, which sort of took him out of the.
It's the publicity loop for a while, getting
these guys together at the same time, even just to come to a premiere and do a bit of publicity, has been
it's funny really watching tricky. This whole sort of film window sort of thing that I didn't realise existed, which basically, you know, a whole lot of films, like our film is a mid-range sized film, so all the films that are bigger than us, we're waiting to see what they do, and we're seeing which window we can slot into, and then all the ones that are smaller than us are waiting to see what we do before they choose where they're going to slot in. It's a funny, mysterious world, that one.
Yeah, also it's a hopscotch release, and which is the first time that I've dealt with a bigger, in this case, Australian-based distributor, and you know they've definitely got high hopes for the film. Even though, they're aware that it's an eclectic, it's not your ordinary kind of blockbuster. They're hoping that people will, Kiwis and Australians will really respond to it, and so they're very, very focused on they've always been focused on making sure it's got the right date and that both Brett and Hamish are available to publicise it.
And both characters.
Yeah. But fact is, if the Rugby World Cup hadn't happened last year, we would have released it probably a year ago.
Right. Followed by the election.
Followed by the election, followed by an Oscar nomination.
Just a stream of things.
And so is it going out in Australia roughly the same period? Roughly the same
It hasn't been dated for Australia. Roughly the same. I mean, we're hoping it'll either be late this year or very early next year. We're lucky to have such a great distributor in Hopscotch because, they're Sydney based and obviously they can see a lot of potential in Australia as well with Hamish Blake being such a kind of big star over there. I mean, I don't think New Zealanders realise that.
Going to be a question. Who is he, and why should I know about him? Because he's not on my radar.
He wasn't on our radar either when he auditioned, and then we heard about him and heard what a massive figure he was in Australia.
Yeah, you go. He's just mobbed everywhere he goes in Australia. He won the Logie Award for best entertainer and best TV show this year. And he's got a million. He's got more fans than the Concords have on Facebook. It's over 1.5 million fans on Facebook. He's got a show on TV3 at the moment.
And in real life, he is he's genuinely funny and one of these personalities that's a little bit on all the time. And it's just incredible, the torrent and the way his mind works. We were all a bit astonished by it. He does have an incredible talent in it. Just for me, sitting back and watching the whole thing, Rob was working with the actors. It was wonderful watching Rob work effectively with two people who are natural comedians, and so Rob didn't have to worry so much about the comedy side of things, just to allow them enough freedom to express themselves on that level and to bring their own thing into it. But watching Rob just make sure that layered into their performance was the character, the journey, what they're going through, so that they're actually, despite the fact that there's a bit of improv here and there, they are very much experiencing it during the making of the film, and therefore in the end result. You're seeing characters, you're not seeing Brett and Hamish, you're definitely seeing Nige and Dino, but they do bring their skills to it beautifully.
I'm looking forward to seeing how it plays across New Zealand and across the rest of the world when it gets the opportunity. Robert Sarkies, Duncan Sarkies, thanks very much for being on Cinematica.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks.